theory is that banks can provide very valuable services to society in the form of liquidity production and maturity transformation and all of those things, but in doing so they expose themselves to fragility, and the classic articles of Diamond and Dibvig demonstrate that maturity transformation by banks is socially valuable, but it exposes them to the risk of runs even though they don't have fundamental problems. It runs caused by expectations of everybody, and that's where you need a central bank to be available to lend as the last resort lender on good collateral, but at penalty interest rates. So I think we have, you know, it's different, I think, to the case of other industries, and it's partly because banks are so highly levered with, in particular, short-term deposits and longer-term assets. And I think that's where, when one looks at all of these issues, that's where trying to enforce higher capital requirements, such as you've got greater equity buffers, is a huge part of the approach to try and at least reduce the costs of being too big to fail, that there is a buffer of equity holders who will bear the costs if banks do get into trouble. I mean, theory doesn't give you any good guidance on what is too big to fail. A large part of it relates to the interconnectedness between institutions, as we saw in the global financial crisis. That being said, the Financial Stability Board or the Basel Committee have identified 28 globally systemically important banks, and APRA has designated the four major banks as being domestically systemically important banks and applied higher capital ratios. But I think it's sort of fairly obvious that the four big banks are different to everybody else in the consequences of what would happen if one of them failed. But again, I think we'll never see it, because I don't think politicians will ever sit by and let a major bank fail in a disruptive manner to the economy.
Ask yourself the question, what would we do if we were building this system with a clean sheet of paper? What we do at the moment is we back institutions which are extremely complex, and they do the maturity transformation. I wonder, and I watched as the securitised markets, the markets for securitisation collapsed during the global crisis, and we backed banks. I wonder whether, if we didn't come with a couple of hundred years of history, whether we mightn't have actually done it the other way around. Because securitizers have built their book to sell to an outsider. They've actually engineered this to maximize transparency. Now, of course, that's almost a joke, because CDOs were the exact opposite of transparency, but I'm actually thinking about Australian securitized paper, for instance, which is a bundle of prime mortgages. So I think that you might, if you've got this challenge to put the state behind maturity transformation as the last port of call, you might well say that it's the aspects of the shadow banking system that would be where you would want to build from. And in the kind of scenario that I'm talking about, you actually take the assets out. At least when you can identify them, which, and I've suggested that a super collateralised mortgage, which for argument's sake is a 60% loan to valuation ratio for a prime residential mortgage and 40% for a commercial mortgage, that you can then put the central bank's maturity transformation guarantee behind that asset, pull the asset into the monetary system and out of the financial system, which is much more expensive. And I think you've got a safer, more efficient system. Just worth thinking about, and it's worth thinking about the way in which we're locked in to a particular logic because we're defending the institutions that have come down to us from the 18th and 19th century.